Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Krang, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kale Teeter, and Russell Young, discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 508, being recorded on the 3rd of December, 2024. Today, I have all my esteemed colleagues, Russell, Evan, and Kale here with me on the call, and we're going to talk about some of the news that was announced recently during Ignite, right? Typically encapsulated in something called the Ignite Book of News, which, of course, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But there are a lot of it covers a lot of different technologies in Microsoft. And of course, this being the Azure Podcast, we'll focus on more of the Azure-related news in there. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. But before that, let's just cover some updates that we may have missed, because it seems like a lot of folks were busy with Ignite, right? So we weren't able to get like any of the usual product teams, et cetera, to come on the call. So we've been actually off the air, so to speak, for a couple of weeks now. There's a few things that we have to catch up on, right? So there's some news items out there. So I know Evan and Russell, you guys had some items there. Why don't you go ahead and get us started?
Sure. I mean, first thing, Russell, I mean, like liking the rock in the facial hair. Glad to see that you've joined the party here on that. But as far as news from the Azure world, and by the way, mine's a little bit of a hodgepodge. I went through all the announcements and pulled out some of the things that I thought were interesting. So just sort of going through them in order in my notes. First one for Azure Flexible Server, continuing to add features and capabilities to this one. This one, I think we sort of snuck in there, but I think it's so critical. Starting actually this month now, MySQL Flexible Server is zone redundant by default. You don't have to opt into anything. You don't have to reconfigure anything. New deployments will be zone redundant by default. That's just huge, right? Because we're giving customers the resiliency without them having to opt into it. One is that VMSS, and this is sort of on the zonal contract as well, is that you can now flag your VMSS regional deployments as you want them to be zonal. And what we will do is as VMs naturally come in and leave within that regional VM scale set, they will be deployed in a zonal fashion. So you don't have to like turn everything off and then restart everything. Just as you sort of get a natural add removal of VMs, it'll slowly distribute itself across the zones. Again, it's sort of a real seamless way of sneakily getting zone redundant in there. Public IP address prefixes, applying them to VMs. This is like you've always been able to add individual IPs to your secondary NICs. Now what you can actually do is you can add a range of IPs. So instead of having to put, if you have 20 or 30 different IPs, you don't have to add them all at once, or individually you can add them as a range. Again, sort of just simplifying something that is already there. Going back to VMSS, and again, I like this from a resiliency perspective. The max surge capability went GA. And what this does is, let's say you're doing rolling updates. Like, let's say you have 9 VMs in your scale set. Yesterday, without max surge, if we do a OS upgrade, for example, or you do an OS upgrade or a model upgrade, you'll actually lose some of your compute capacity, which can really be a problem if you're under load when you do that, or your load never goes to zero. And so what we've done now with the max surge is it basically adds the number of VMs that are going to get removed as part of the update domain rolling through. It'll add them ahead of time so that you never drop below some number of compute. Again, really good really handy from a stability perspective. The Azure Boost, we actually talked about this on we had some folks from that engineering team on the show a couple months back, continuing to talk about Azure Boost more publicly and expanding the scenarios when that gets used. Also, in the container apps world, we've now added the planned maintenance experience. And this is the same capability that's showing up in more and more services across Azure. I believe App Gateway's got it. VPN Gateway and ExpressRoute Gateway are getting variants of this. But basically, you're able to define a maintenance window, and that is the window during which we will apply maintenance to your VMs, to your resources that are deployed, again, giving you some control over that. And then last but not least, and again, this one, full disclosure, has nothing to do with Azure. I saw this and just thought this was really cool, but those of us that live in the sort of the memory dump world have been using proc dump for 20 years now to get memory dumps from processes in sort of a nice and easy way. Proc dump for Mac version 1.0 just got released about 3 weeks ago. Again, it's really cool to see tooling that you know used to be sort of Windows specific just becoming generalized tooling. Right, that's just really where we as a company and where the industry as a whole has gone. It's just kind of cool to see. I never thought I would see that. If you'd asked me 20 years ago, why, you know, locked up me on a map. No way, never happened. It's a Windows thing. But nope, it's out. And I'm pretty sure the dev that was working on it is one of the folks who does the Windows internals book, I think. I think it's one of the co-authors of that. Cool. But yeah, it's just neat to see.
Yeah,
it's good to see you still get excited by that kind of thing, Evan.
I just wanted to cover a couple of things that Evan mentioned, which specifically around the zonal redundancy, right? You talked about that, and really, I can't wait for the day when all our services are, are basically zonal redundant, right? I spent a lot of time recently with a financial services customer that has VMs that are zone, you know, kind of in a zone only. And they have to find out if the zone is in trouble and then switch to another zone and do. And we had to write all these fancy scripts and do all this fancy monitoring to kind of make it happen. I believe like all our services should be zone redundant, right? There is no reason why, because it's such a pain in the neck to, it's such a pain in the neck to kind of figure out those things. Nobody should have to do that. And kind of related to that, you mentioned about the planned maintenance. Right. I believe, with planned maintenance, I believe AKS, had a similar issue where you have to add no new nodes. And same thing, you know, in the Mac search. So now they add a node first and they remove a node. And so they maintain that sort of capacity. So it's good to see that. But I'm just surprised they
use the same terminology, the same MacSearch terminology.
MacSearch, yeah. But I'm just surprised, though, that we still have to involve customers with planned maintenance, right? This is something that, you know, I know it's not a very Microsoft-friendly kind of discussion to have.
It's a fair question, though. It's fair.
But, you know, in a world where we're all going towards PaaS services, right, we all assume that these are PaaS services that are supposed to be up all the time. Why in the world are we asking our customers, you know, to set up planned maintenance, right? What is this gray area that we have to get them involved in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's one conversation I have with customers a lot. Obviously, our gold standard is any update, any change can be done with no downtime for the customer. That's what we shoot for. That's what we aim for. That's our, you know, North Star for it. Unfortunately, the technical reality comes up that there are components, there are parts of, Windows, parts of AKS, parts of SQL, like parts of everything that were just not there from a technical reality perspective. Sometimes it's a protocol thing. Like VPN as a protocol, like, doesn't handle that well. IPsec doesn't do well with that. So we actually had to change the way that we handled data plane versus control plane traffic in the VPN. It took us years to do that work. And so there are places you just can't do it for technical limitations. So there's always going to be some element of it. I think really the evolution is we used to, it's almost the reverse where we used to just do it for you. And then we got pretty resounding feedback of, hey, this caused this impact for me, give me some control over it. So adding the features and the capabilities is really more about acknowledging the technical reality that we can't always do it seamless. And for customers with a critical workload, giving them the ability to specify that window. So it's okay. Really about sort of balancing.
It's like a transparency, more transparency into our
absolutely
workflow.
There's actually lots of these where when we do the upgrade, we actually think, you know, like live migration is a good example, right? Vast majority of workloads don't get impacted by live migration. But if your workload is one of that really small percentage that is impacted by that, the ability to specify that maintenance window might be the thing that makes or breaks your critical workload. Right. So it, you know, it's again, it's this sort of hypothetically, this is what we want versus the technical reality and the business reality, right? Seconds matter to some workloads. It's amazing how critical some workloads are.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, so I had a couple of updates that weren't in the book of news, and I don't know when I missed them, but I did miss them. It's not along the line. Both related to API Manager and APIs, and one of them actually came after a customer conversation, and it's quite a common situation with a large organization that's got lots of APIs all across their organization, possibly in you know, almost third-party parts of the organization as well, where they publish their own APIs. They may have an instance of API Manager on the front of it. They may be running it on premise. They may be running it, you know, elsewhere. And obviously the organization looks to try and centralize as much of that governance as they can and make it consistent and have observability and all those good things over it. We talked before about API Center, which is more about how do I discover and document some of those services and find them. But there's always been this issue around what's the best strategy for API Manager. Do I have one instance that I centralize and put all of my APIs into and everything goes through there? Or do I have multiple instances, one per part of the organization and try and do it that way? And there's pros and cons with each of them, right? So if you put it all centralized, then you have one administration team and you're applying one set of permissions across those things. And should something happen, it's going to affect all of the instances of the APIs that are running on that execution hardware. If you silo them out, then you lose a lot of that centralized ability, centralized governance, and so on. But you have the benefits of isolation, but it's basically running in silos. So what there is now in API Manager to kind of to get around this is a new feature called Workspaces, which basically offers you federated API management. And in my mind, for a large organization, it's kind of the best of both worlds, because you're offering the ability to delegate permissions and administration to sub teams and other parts of project teams that work there. But you're also applying centralized governance and controls to those APIs. So you've got that visibility and observability. And the execution pattern is such that they're all isolated per those teams and projects that you break up into the different federated organizations. So that was a really interesting one. So I need to have a bit of more of a play with it, but it looks like a good solution to those organizations that are quite big and want to have that kind of control and bring stuff in. The second one was, again, related to API Manager, and this was Defender for API Management. Another product that you can bolt on basically to the Defender suite. And it adds a whole host of features to REST-based APIs. It's only REST-based APIs at the moment, but I think there's plans to extend that to other formats. So it will do things like identify externally used or addressed unauthenticated APIs. It allows you to classify APIs that can respond with sensitive data. Apply configuration recommendations to enhance your security posture. And it also does some anomaly detection, looking for suspicious API traffic, abiding to some of the OWASP recommendations that exist. So all about threat remediation and, looking after that stuff proactively for you. So those are the two for me. Sorry.
Russell, on that second feature, so that's really, it's really about scanning the traffic for the APIs to look for problematic traffic, right? Like it's not, I mean, I guess it might tell you this API is sending it, you know, insecure information, so you need to go change the API, but it's really more about identifying the ones that you have to go fix. Is that the right way to think about it?
Recommendations around that. Okay. So it's all about that, observing stuff, looking at it and one thing I have just read is that this feature currently isn't available in Workspaces, which was the feature I talked about beforehand. So there's a bit of irony for you, but I'm sure it's coming soon.
They did that to you on purpose, Russell.
Yes. Great. Those are good updates. So let's catch all our listeners up on some of the news that was announced during Ignite 2024. They covered a wide variety of updates there. We'll focus more on the Azure-related updates here, of course. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, you know, all I saw was, you know, Azure AI Foundry, right? That seemed to dominate sort of the Azure related news. I mean, there's, of course, other areas which like Fabric was there, but again, it's all AI related. This security, of course, some security updates to Azure, et cetera. But did I see that correctly, that it's all about this new AI Foundry?
It seemed like it.
Yeah.
Every other word was AI. I actually felt a little bit bad as somebody coming in from the Azure world, Azure infrastructure world. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there were a few Azure. I think you mentioned one of them with Azure Boost and all that. So there were a few kind of updates on that were also sprinkled in there. You know, I was reading up on this Azure AI Foundry and actually had some meetings with some other account reps who have been using it recently. I think like all of us, we've all been playing around with or helping customers use AI in their applications. And I think over time, what happens is you realize there's a certain sort of, life cycle or a certain workflow that everyone seems to go through, right? And there's certain kind of applications patterns that have emerged out of all of these. I think, you know, we can, it's a handful of patterns that have emerged. And so to me, it looks like what Azure AI Foundry aims to do is to bring all that together, right, in one place. Here's the most common scenarios. Here's the steps that everyone typically goes through. Of course, you can wander away from those set of steps, but, you know, just to give you like a guided experience through all of the various things that you would want to do to make sure that you're able to get your AI application successfully deployed into production. And for me, you know, that seems to be like the overarching sort of message with the Azure AI Foundry. I think Cale was talking about earlier before the call that it's, you know, AI Foundry borrows from a lot of existing services, right? It's not something brand new as such, but it's kind of bringing a whole lot of things together.
Yeah, I think previously you had different portals and UIs aimed specifically at different roles. So those coming from a data science background would go into AI Studio, for example, or ML Studio, rather. Now you're bringing all those things together and all those features into one place, and it just kind of, like you say, it hooks it all together and gives you a one-stop shop for everything. And I think, yeah, down to the Book of News mainly being about AI, I think AI is driving a lot of the innovation in most services, and everyone is looking at how can my service support AI and how can AI support my service. So it works both ways, right? So it's kind of self-fulfilling and driving a lot of the development.
Yeah, on the Foundry piece, back to what you were talking about, Sajid, I think people who have been around for a little while using some of our tools like Azure OpenAI and the machine learning stuff that we've had for many years, you know, in the portal, I think those people will be more confused than new people because, you know, it's a little bit like, wait, that was that service before. Like, wait, why is it over here now? Like, you know, that kind of thing. So if you come into this brand new, it probably looks like, wow, this is all planned out. Looks awesome, you know, but it was bringing a lot of that stuff together because each one of those, to Russell's point, was focused on roles, right? And it's still good, still relevant, right? It's not like we have to throw all that stuff out. It's more about like how, to your point, Sajid, how do we connect those so people can build applications and integrate these services in a much better way? I think, when you start talking about like models and doing like training and specialized models and all that kind of stuff, I find that with the AI Foundry a little easier to understand because I think the older interface that we had before was a little bit more hands-on, we'll call it. Like you had to know a lot more internal to do that kind of stuff, where the new way kind of helps you get through that, like the model catalog and stuff like that is much easier to see, you know.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. I think the model catalog is sort of the biggest enhancement to this because, as it turns out, you know, it's not just the GPT models now. There's models from Amazon, from Meta. Say all of these models are becoming popular. Some of them are classified as large language models, which means, you know, they're too big to download to your computer. And some of them are, like, you know, small language models like Phi 3. But eventually you want to try all of these models, right? A developer would want to try them. Yes, you can kind of take the big hammer and solve all of your problems with the most expensive model like GPT-4o, right? But that's expensive, right? And so you got to weigh that. Like, do I really need all the power of GPT-4o for everything? Or can I try some of these other models? And so being able to experiment with that, I think, is one of the first features that they've added into the Foundry.
Does Frown, one of the, you know, I think you hit on an interesting sort of twist, Sajid, on sort of the cultural aspect. And I, full confession, I'm not an AI person. I'm an infrastructure person. So I'm speaking from sort of historical perspective. But there absolutely is sort of a bias. Most companies tend to push the models that they build and they make money off of, right? That's the way we go. Microsoft, we play both sides because we're about building, you know, IDEs, and, you know, AI Foundry feels like sort of an IDE for the AI world, right? It's probably not the perfect comparison, but it feels close. And from an IDE perspective, most modern IDEs support, you know, Ruby, Python, Visual Code supports every language you could ever think of, plus a whole bunch of Azure stuff. It may even have AWS integrations. Is AI Foundry about sort of bringing that, you know, cross-company, cross-model visibility to it versus similar tools are, hey, if I'm using the tooling from company A, I'm really being steered towards the models, you know, the large language models for company A? Is that part of what this is about?
I think one part, just to interject a little bit there, Evan, is like the multi-model world, right? So when we first started, it was like, hey, we have these models, right? So we have GPT-3.5 and 4 and all these different things. But now it's like beyond that, right? So now it's like, hey, part of my thing can actually just use this model, but part of it uses
because I need different models for different parts of my app.
So things like image processing could be done by something, and that's using a different model than a thing that's using looking at text recognition and stuff like that kind of stuff. So
Just on that point, while you're talking about multi-models and so on, I don't know if you've seen, but GitHub Copilot now allows you to choose which model, which LLM you want to use as well. So by default, it's using 4.0, which is great for most stuff that you want. But if you want to ask it to do stuff which may require some more, thinking, but more, it's that reasoning type model, you might want to go for 0.1 or 0.1 mini or something like that. So there's an option now in there to, I think it's in preview, but you can choose different models. And that's quite interesting now, right? Because people have to then kind of, you know, as a consumer, I need to understand which model is going to fit the use case best. So maybe there'll be another model on top of that analyzes my question and then figures out which one the right one is.
It feels like it's got to go that way eventually, otherwise you're just in trouble.
Yeah, I think GitHub Copilot has always done that for me anyway, somewhere along the line. It's kind of looking and saying, okay, which models do I need to make use of? And there was Codex or GPT or what have you, depending on which part of the flow you're looking at. So, yeah, it's interesting, though.
Yeah, and you do bring up a good point, Evan, is that, you know, what does, like, from Microsoft perspective, you know, what's in it for us, right, to support all these models? And eventually these models have to run somewhere, right? They need compute.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And so, you know, at the very bottom layer, that's what is in it for us, right? Is that we're going to run these models somewhere. We can talk about later. We're going to talk about some of the new serverless GPU SKUs that are available now, announced in the Book of News. But these models have to run somewhere. And so even if you use, you know, a meta model or some other model from like a small language model, you know, those models are available. I think they call it model as a service in Azure. So in Azure AI, so you can run any model as a service. You get an API endpoint and you can have to. Now, obviously, some models are cheaper to run because they're, you know, they're smaller, more defined. They take up less GPUs and CPUs and whatnot. Whereas others like the big kahunas like GPT-4o, you know, will take up the most amount of compute, right? So they'll be the most expensive to run. And so, you know, trying to figure out which one's the right one for me from my cost point and for what I want to do is what I think that initial entry point into the Foundry is all about, right? Like, let me experiment with all these models. Traditionally, it's been like you need to have an Azure subscription to try these models, right? This has been the traditional thing. So there is always a little bit of sort of upfront costs, maybe, you know, you need to, like, you know, open up a subscription and maybe put a credit card in or whatever it is, you know, to get things started. There is a new feature that GitHub is offering now as part of the update. It's called GitHub Models, right? And so you can ask GitHub using the app. I think it's called at Models. I think you can have a chat with GitHub Copilot and say, hey, which model is good for me for this use case? And it'll say, okay, maybe this model is good. And then you can try that model right there in GitHub Copilot for free now. You can say, let's ask this question of this model, right? If it says like GPT-4o mini, okay, ask GPT-4o mini this question. I want to see what kind of answer I get for it. And it'll tell you the answer right there. And you could see, okay, yeah, this thing, this model really performs. This is good for me.
Exactly.
So there is like this free option that's available in GitHub Models now, just to allow you to kind of quickly iterate and figure out which is the right model for me, right? Right in your code base, in GitHub Copilot, it's right there.
I think something that I'm super excited about, along with this whole discussion of, cost of a model and using AI Foundry and those things and other things, is SLM to LLM, because new hardware like the new Surfaces and MacBooks.
So, SLM is for those of us that are not small, language model.
The popular one is like Pi 3, is what Microsoft has, right? But there's a bunch of them, right? So you could have specialized ones. For instance, think about a future where you're writing code and you have a huge code base with your team, but you don't necessarily have that in GitHub or on the internet. You could be reasoning over that with a small language model on your machine and then branch over to a bigger one if you need to, right? So you can kind of scale that. I think that's super cool, right? I'm super excited about it.
Yeah, and glad you brought about the SLMs, because the decision whether to use an LLM or an SLM, is based on your experimentation. But then what you have to do is you find out, okay, I have this SLM, maybe like a 5.3 that suits me, but I need to tune it. I need to adjust it, to be more specific to my domain, right? My business domain, my language that I use in my company. And so there's this process of fine tuning now, which is also included in the Foundry, right? So the next step, once you figure out your model, the next step in your flow is, okay, let me tune it, right? To work the way I want to. And so that is now included in it. It uses there's some basic fine tuning available, or if you use the weights and biases services, a service portal, which is another fine tuning service that's out there, it's integrated with Azure OpenAI now, so the two can work together. That's in the next step sort of in this workflow, and that is supported in the portal as well.
I was going to talk about when you mentioned the at symbol thing in GitHub Copilot and that kind of plugin to support, and you can add all those different plugins that support you in different ways. One of the interesting things that we're seeing now is how people want to access AI, how people want to leverage the services that you're building. And one of the big pieces of news from Ignite was, one of the big phrases that I heard was autonomous agentic capabilities. And this is all about trying to leverage AI on your or creating processes that run on their own, that respond to things that are happening or respond to timed events, to then carry out that piece of AI that you were running your workflow to. So I think that's a really interesting capability, and I've seen lots of pop-ups and areas within some of the SaaS tools that we use within Microsoft 365, where you've just got a button that you can click and say, oh, I want to schedule this to carry out this task for me on a regular basis, or every time you see this, carry out this piece of stuff. So I think that's interesting. And when you're talking to things now, chatbots, it used to be really obvious that you're talking to a chatbot. Now, I don't know if I can say the same thing. Even the ones that operate using voice, it's becoming to the point where I know in the UK, one of our telecom providers produced an AI agent that is voice, and you could basically redirect a scammer directly to this thing called Granny Scam, I think she's called, something like that. And she will have a conversation with the scammer directly.
Oh, that's just awesome.
To put them off the scent. And I've listened to a recording over a 20-minute period of somebody talking to this and interviewing this granny. And, you wouldn't know. It's incredible. She does such a good job of what she's been programmed to do. But that's where we could be going, right? So scammers may have AI that's going to talk to AI on the back end that's going to try and postpone them. But yeah.
And as the infrastructure guy, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but isn't it great? You know,
sort of
at the moment, you know, I rely on Teams. You go into Teams, you ask people, you're always asking peers for support and help and stuff. If you can just ask Copilot there, and it's doing all this great stuff, it just becomes a part of your built behaviors now. That I don't mind if it's a person or an AI I'm talking to, if I'm going to get the result.
Yeah, along with the agents thing, something that was a little bit, I won't say it's under the radar, but there was a lot of hoopla around AI Foundry and things like that. There was also this thing called declarative agents that we talked about a bit at Ignite, or even like a little bit after Ignite. Just to speak to that for a second, because I've been involved with that a little bit, is, we got this whole gamut. Like when you're building AI applications, to your point, Russell, these things are becoming morphing into new things. And originally it was a chatbot kind of interface, right? And so we have things internally, like we have frameworks, and there's other frameworks out there, but like Semantic Kernel is one that we have that basically allows us to build plugins for data and things like that. Because one of the things people want to do right away with these chatbots is not, or copilots rather, is not just like asking about the web and things like that, but I have data that's so massive, I want to ask a question. So how do I plug that data in securely, right? And so we have built frameworks to do that, but that's hard, right? That takes a lot of time, takes a lot of engineering effort to do that. And then on the other side of that, we had Copilot Studio, which was like super low code. Just come and drag these things onto a surface, kind of like a power application, and do it that way. Where declarative agents kind of fit in the middle, because we can basically do some coding, some engineering piece that we need to there, but we don't have to like do everything from scratch, you know, kind of thing with Semantic Kernel. I'm not saying that's bad. Like in some cases you want to do everything from scratch, but this gives us a faster on-ramp to be able to bring our own data and start rationalizing, having a copilot use it and things like that. Hence why it's called declarative agents, because there's less code to write, but I wouldn't call it a low code solution. It's a little bit more code. Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe it can use logic apps and functions and, you know, all sorts of external endpoints, right? So it can be a complete line of business application, right? And using AI. I wanted to mention one thing earlier. We talked about fine-tuning of models, right? So fine-tuning of models typically requires us to provide a lot of examples to the model, right? And there's an interesting concept that's discussed in the book and news. It's called distillation of models, okay? And what they do is they take, it's sort of like the teacher-student relationship between models. So if you think of the GPT-4o, which we know is the big kahuna model, right? And whatever comes thereafter, is the teacher model, right? It knows sort of generically about everything, right? And then the student model is your sort of maybe a small language model or one of the smaller like GPT-4 or mini, you know, the smaller models that doesn't have all of the smarts of the bigger model. So the bigger model can actually teach the smaller model. So you can get the bigger model to teach the smaller model certain things to work more better for your use case, right? So you can ask the bigger model to generate a bunch of samples that would help it fine-tune the smaller model. So actually the fine-tuning process got a lot easier now by using this distillation process, right? So the advantage is that you only use the very expensive bigger models once during fine-tuning. Once you've generated the fine-tuning data, you pass it on to the smaller model. Now the smaller models are cheaper to run, but they're running within your defined constraints or whatever you have fine-tuned it on. So I found that was like quite a nice process where they have that distillation. And of course, then they have controls in there where you can monitor how it's, you know, do evaluations on the model to see is it performing well, are you getting the right outputs, is the content have any harmful information in there, things like that, right? So those sort of steps are also built into the overall workflow. But this is again all part of that kind of system as you're coming up with your new models that you want to use.
I realize we're running out of time, but I just wanted to touch on a point
too much info.
Well, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot to read up on each of these things as well. But to the point earlier about the AI, the AI compute leading some of the infrastructure changes and some of the services that we've got. There were a couple of announcements around Azure Container Apps, one of which was called Dynamic Sessions, and one called Serverless GPUs. Serverless GPUs, I thought, was quite interesting because that's obviously the ability to spin up containers that have GPU in there. So if you want to run AI compute In a serverless environment, it's there for you to do that without having to manage all the infrastructure, because that's one of the big issues that, you know, people doing machine learning and stuff complain about is first of all, they run out of VMs and run out of scale. So using all that compute stuff that we do within ML Studio is great.
And just the availability of GPUs is still a problem these days, right? So the serverless GPUs are a much easier way because they're on demand and you're more likely to get that capacity, as opposed to saying, give me a VM with a GPU dedicated to me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And dynamic sessions, I thought, was an interesting one. So this is kind of around the ability to spin up this dynamic session, which is basically a sandboxed, isolated, secure environment that's got Python and it's got some of the most common libraries already kind of pre-installed on it. And you can use this, the idea being that you can use it to execute code that's been generated by LLMs and other models. So I can think of examples where you might have maybe a rules engine that runs at runtime and you want to be able to configure those rules using natural English and have the LLM create some code that runs in that instance that extends some SAS software or something like that. So really interesting stuff. So it doesn't matter if something happens, it's totally isolated and it's not going to go and break the rest of your system or cause some security issues. So I thought they were useful to call out.
It's interesting to see, and this is the typical sort of life cycle we talked about earlier, right? Like, it started out, these models are off in this own isolated world and you have to go do all this special stuff to leverage them. They're coming, you know, the low code integration, you know, world is bringing them closer, and then, you know, scenarios where you can just do one little piece of your code, you know, is this LLM. Like, that's really the progression, because nobody gets to live in a vacuum of they're all one or all the other. Everybody's living in this blended world, right? Like, it's got to be the way things go. Like, there's no question.
Yeah, let me quickly cover a couple of others, if you don't mind. The Azure content, AI content understanding, I think, is a really nice service, because, you know, we see a lot of use cases where people have PDFs or images that they want to kind of extract information off, right? And so the AI content understanding service has these common templates where you say, okay, here's my bunch of PDFs, going to extract the important information from there and make it available to me. So that's certainly one. Did you guys catch the news about Azure Local? Yeah, which I thought was interesting.
I did see that. I'm still trying to get that one in my head, but I did.
So Azure Stack has been renamed to Azure Local, right?
So I guess that sort of makes sense, right?
It's my local Azure, right? So I think the name change is probably better. It kind of gives that whole thing. But the same thing, you know, all these hardware vendors are creating these server stack racks and whatnot that you can deploy in your own office and be part of Azure. So, and it's, of course, Azure Arc is the one that kind of, you know, ties it all back into Azure. So certainly that's all available there.
Those guys didn't get the memo on, we call things small and large now, so we could call it small Azure and large Azure. But
mini, that's all. Mini Azure. That's funny, though. That's a good one. There's a lot of updates on Fabric, right? SQL Server now supports vector databases. I don't know if you call that. That's pretty cool. So if you know, obviously we have Azure AI Search as a vector database. We have Cosmos DB, which is a vector database, and now Azure SQL is joining the bandwagon as well. So any one of them can be used to store all your assets that you want to search using language. What else have we got here? Yeah. AI Fabric. I think we all remember Agent Service. Thanks for covering all of that, Kale. Yeah. Anything else that you guys think?
There's lots we didn't cover, but you know, I think we stuffed as much as we can into the time we had.
The GitHub thing you mentioned about models, there is a VS Code extension for it, which is super awesome. If you start experimenting with that, any of our listeners, download that. I think it's just called like AI Toolkit or something like that. We could put a link in the show notes, but it's awesome. Like, you can, like, within seconds, like, hit one of these things and start chatting with it. It's like, wow, that's pretty wild.
That is cool.
And then, Kale, I don't know if you normally like to cover this topic on the Azure Essentials, right? I think you've often covered in the past how it now supports the Cloud Adoption Framework, right? I think you've mentioned that before, the Azure Well-Architected Framework. So they're all now support AI workloads. This is in Azure Essentials, which is sort of the last step, right? We talked about this workflow, this entire step. Eventually, you want to deploy this somewhere securely. And so there's something called Azure Essentials, which is sort of your, you know, okay, this is how you deploy these things correctly. And oh, by the way, for AI, these are the really, you know, these are the ways you deploy these things securely into your environment. So all that is, you know, part of that lifecycle that we're trying to put out there. But yeah, so that's all the updates. Well, this has been great. Thanks for sharing all those tips and news and perspectives. We will get, you know, I think now that there are
we just scheduled teams, one yesterday, so we got more stuff coming. So
we'll have more regular sessions now that the product team's back on being available. So look forward to that. All right?
Great. Catch y'all there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on LinkedIn. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.